think we both just sort of realized how much fun we had sort of taking up that space with all of the conversations that we were sort of having, you know, just us two or with a lot of our like-minded feminist pals. But sort of getting that down on paper and having something tangible just felt so fun and great for us to do.
Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. For episode 63, we are joined by not one, but two incredible women. Jay Yule is a dance artist and choreographer whose work is influenced by feminist philosophies with a particular interest in readdressing the audience and performer relationship. In 2018, she graduated from the prestigious Conservatoire of Music and Dance, Trinity Laban, with a BA in contemporary dance. She has worked with dance royalty, choreographers such as Theo Klinkard, Luca Silvestrini, and Sarah Fahey, and has performed in a number of productions, both in the UK and internationally. A highlight being performing in The Damnation of Faust at Glenbourne Festival Opera in 2019. Jay has also worked with organisations such as Mandinga Arts, who deliver extraordinary outdoor performances and processions. She's also a member of the Yonis, a girl band who make multidisciplinary work with the intention of empowering fellow women to take space and make noise. And our second guest is Leah Airy, production assistant at Shoot Europe, a production house based in London. Leah graduated with the first class honours from Birmingham University in 2018 with a BA in fashion, design and communication. But despite studying full-time, she managed to cram her degree with extracurricular activities. She interned as a stylist and also worked for Grazia. And during her placement year, she was an assistant to the incredible CEO and fashion director of Tank Form and Tank Magazine, Caroline Isa, as well as juggling a placement at Wonderland Magazine. Her remit was broad, from managing schedules to art direction and everything else in between. On completing her studies, she moved to London, securing first a role at Shoot Europe as a junior production assistant, progressing to her current role as production assistant, where she's responsible for bookings, research, kit, and post-production schedules. And together, Jay and Leah collaborate on Viva La Volva, a celebration of female and non-binary sexuality. Originally both from Edinburgh and friends from childhood, the project grew out of shared notions of shame and humiliation when talking with friends and peers about sex. They create and facilitate ways of exploring and stripping away the restrictive roles placed on women and non-binary individuals by patriarchal structures. From dance to zine making, they focus on shifting the social legacy of conformity, empowering women to explore a sense of ownership within their sex. I was super lucky to attend their last zine making workshop at the end of 2019. It was brilliant, super open, and we had heaps of fun reappropriating images, sanitary towels, and tampons. I was particularly enamored with some sparkly red tassels. Jay and Leah, I'm so looking forward to talking about your careers, vulvas, bleeding, and sex with you. Welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What an intro.
I'm going to split the interview into two parts. I'm going to talk to you, Jay, a little bit about your dance and your choreography, and then Leah about your kind of background in working within magazine and fashion, and then also in the production world. And then we're going to come together and talk about Viva La Volva.
Great.
So, kicking off, Jay, can you tell me what you do as a dance artist and a choreographer?
So, yeah, as a dancer, I am lucky enough to work quite varied jobs. I, as you said in my intro, I work for Mandinga, who are a carnival arts company, but they basically have a warehouse full of big scale puppets that you kind of are inside. So for those gigs, I'm often inside a puppet, embodying a character, engaging with members of the public, maybe outside on the street, or we did some gigs recently for Jax Jones. We were in big arenas with like pyrotechnics and stuff. That was like huge and really far away from the audience, so even within that's quite varied. I then get to do quite intimate work Like at the moment I'm working on a project with Joe Fong, which is kind of addressing being Chinese and living in the UK, but using that as a basis for coming together, embracing our differences and working together. So it's a work which is, there's like 3-year-old babies in it, or there's elderly people in it. It's a really big cast of musicians, singers and dancers. So that's really fun because it's, again, hugely varied, but there's a lot of contact work. And then sometimes I get to work in operas, which means I'm just a tiny little part of a huge big operation. And there's, you know, an orchestra, a chorus of singers, a conductor who's giving me notes, a choreographer, and then a director. So it's, my job as a dancer is hugely varied. And then my work as a choreographer, again, I'm really lucky. I work on things like Viva La Volva, which is kind of, I have full artistic control over. I work with another dance artist who's based in Berlin called Ronja Kasemi. And then I'm also working in collaboration with another dance artist called Angel Tirio. And we're doing some research with her practice, which is about softness and tension and kind of using octopi as a stimulus for that and the way that they move. And then my research, which is about penetration, we're kind of using the two to collaborate. And we work together in Nunhead at a space called The Green, where we get to use the space 2 days a week in exchange for putting on community events there and engaging with local people.
So super varied.
Yeah.
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 And how is it crossing over? So working on, say, something like an opera to then working with Mandinga and being out on the street potentially with huge puppets. And how do you manage that?
Well, I suppose everything that I do, I'm kind of learning from, and I do approach that as a thing that I can then, yeah, learn from and bring into my artistic practice, which I've never really known what that means, but I suppose I'm learning. So, for example, it's still being on the street and engaging with children while I'm performing is still going to help me when I'm on a stage and I'm really far away from the audience, because I suppose it's just about interacting with humans and it's all about kind of energy and, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I guess like it's like developing a practice, which is, I've always found such a weird term, especially like in my art practice, because it means like practicing.
Yeah.
And it's weird. And then you realize, oh yeah, it's like, I think it's fair to say that you're a lot younger than me. But yeah, it's like a journey over time. So I still grapple with that notion of a practice as well, because it's never ending. So you're always learning.
Yeah.
And I guess with dance, energy is like key to what you do in terms of, one, just performing from within and then projecting out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also part of the fun of it, which is still to do with dance, but it's also to do with theatre, is kind of like finding like who you are within a character that you're being, as opposed to like putting that character on top of you, like finding who you are in that skin or in that giant costume. Yeah.
As I mentioned, it's relatively new. You're very fresh out the blocks, graduating from university a couple of years ago. So can you tell me about your creative journey arriving to now? You know, why were you inspired to go and study dance?
I always was dancing. I always danced as a kind of hobby in Edinburgh. I started off dancing at a wonderful place called Dance Base, and I started doing hip hop there just for fun. But they had a really great ethos, which was basically anyone can dance. Then when it came to doing, you know, when you're in school and everyone's like, okay, so you've had some fun. What are you going to be? Like, what are you going to do? I was like, am I going to take this a bit more seriously? What am I going to do? And I remember my parents were like, maybe you should just apply to both, you know. It's good to have a backup, because I was veering towards dance being like really what I want to do. So I was applying to uni for music and dance. One of my teachers was like, if you don't get into dance school, are you really going to be happy if then you go and study music and that's what you do. Are you not going to be happier if you wait a year and work really hard and then get in the next year? And I was like, shit, you're so right. Like, wow, thank God for Mr. Shankland.
Oh.
Yeah. So then I chose that dance was going to be, like, really what I was going to pursue. So I thought, if I'm going to be serious about this, I better do some ballet. And around about the same time, I kind of discovered contemporary dance. There's an organisation based in Glasgow called Y Dance, who run some great youth schemes in Scotland. And yeah, I owe them quite a lot for where I am today. When I was actually maybe like 18, I joined the National Youth Dance Company of Scotland, which they run. And we toured around the UK. We did an exchange with the National Youth Dance Company of Wales, which at the time was run by Kerry Nichols, who you've also interviewed. And we also went to Belgium. And I think probably around about the same time when I was then 18 and leaving school, I went to the Scottish School of Contemporary Dance, which is in Dundee. And I did an HND and an NQ, which is like the equivalent of a diploma, I think. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't like living in Dundee. I think I was just hungry for the big city. Yeah, to go from Edinburgh to a smaller town, I really wanted to be kind of immersed in arts and in a big town experiencing different cultures and stuff. Mm. Not that Dundee wasn't great, and I did meet some amazing people there who I've stayed in touch with and are really, really close friends. And I'm also really glad that I went there straight after leaving school, because I think if I came to London straight away, then I would have been massively overwhelmed. So I'm very grateful for those years. But yeah, after that, I went to Trinity Lab and Conservatoire of Music and Dance, where I was surrounded by incredible artistic people, and I loved it. And I got a first class honours. Yeah, and then from then, I've gone on to do all of the things that you've mentioned in my intro. Yeah, one thing that I wanted to say about how I arrived to where I am now is definitely to do with being really lucky to be at some institutions that had a real ethos and attitude towards anyone being able to dance. And I'm really grateful for that. And I think that I wouldn't be where I am now, and I wouldn't have had the encouragement and role models to be where I am now. Yeah, and I think that I like to think that I carry this with me through to my own work and choreography and practice. And I would really love to see the kind of elitism dissipate out of the contemporary dance world. Because, yeah, contemporary dance as it exists from growing out of many, many different styles of dance. So I think that it needs the diversity in order for it to grow and evolve. Yeah.
So you graduated in the summer of 2018. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So since then, that's about 18 months now.
Mm-hmm.
How have you managed, you know, how you work and how things play out? It's like, is there a typical day for you in your role as a dancer, performer, choreographer?
So I wouldn't say that I've got like a set day or even week that's like the same. As Leah likes to put it, I am queen of the side hustle.
That she is.
So, yeah, it's very varied, but I work at a studio called Siobhan Davies Dance. They are a kind of organisation that exists to support dance artists to explore their practice. They run kind of residencies, but they also run morning classes. So I work as a front of house kind of admin there. I do a bit of babysitting, which I was doing yesterday, which is always a joy. I'm a kind of teaching assistant, support for Canduco's youth dance company called Candu 2, so I do that weekly. The rest of the time is kind of juggled with doing odd gigs here and there, maybe a yoni gig, which might not bring in that much money, and then a mandinga gig, which might bring in a lot of money, and then I might get kind of big periods of time, like operas, which tend to be 3-4 month contracts. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it really is a bit of a juggling act, to be honest. Yeah, I'm doing loads of jobs, but I'm just lucky enough I'm managing to juggle it enough to pay the bills, and also I'm kind of lucky enough that I have jobs that are still kind of relevant to what I want to be doing as well.
And how was that coming out of your degree? And I imagine being super pumped, doing 3 years at an amazing conservatoire, and now having to juggle and side hustle and side hustle. Like, what has that transition been like?
Confusing and taking a lot of time to get used to. I think it's a shock. I think it's a shock for everyone, because dance training is so intensive, and like some days are like 8:30 till 6:30, like really long days. And it's also a shock to go from moving that much to then having to pay to do classes. I think it's a shock for a lot of people. And yeah, it was for me as well. I think maybe the thing that I've struggled the most with, though, is like a work-life balance, which I still have not figured out at all. Yeah, I'm just still saying yes to everything, and whether I'm getting paid or not. Yeah, it's hard, but I think I'm still coming to terms with the work very much coming in waves. Also realizing that as a dancer and a dance artist, because of the nature of dance work and the nature of the funding for it in this country, it's very rare that I'm going to be at a stage where I'm just like hopping from contract to contract. I think that there will always be phases of doing something that's not performing, but I suppose it's just about trying to remain within the world, whether that's teaching or, you know, doing admin in a place that's still within the industry that I'm interested in.
It's tough, and it's tough, I guess, like maintain, like we're talking about practice, yeah, and paying the bills,
mm-hmm,
and feeling fulfilled,
yeah,
and getting to hang out with your friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah.
So can you tell me more about the Yonis, how you came to join them, and what the group does?
So the Yonis are a girl band made up of contemporary dancers. I came to join them maybe a year ago, but I kind of danced on and off with them for a few years. The Yonis were formed in 2017 by two of my good friends, Hayley Gash and Charlotte McLean. And they were in a kind of in a similar position to what we've just been speaking about. They just graduated from the contemporary dance school. They wanted to be in a band, but they couldn't play any instruments. So they were like, fuck it, let's just be in a band that dances. And since then, it's kind of just grown and grown and grown. At our last meeting, we sat down and made a list of people that we've had in the Yonis ever, and it was 50 women.
Amazing.
Yeah, and of all different ages as well. The Yonis exist as a girl band. We used to all be based in London, but now we're very spread out. So we kind of come together as much as possible. Back in August, we were supported by The Place and we were choreodrome artists there. So we were in residency for 2 weeks and we made our first album, which is kind of still in the post-production phase at the moment, but we made a whole load of new tracks. And that was the first time that we've been together as the 10 of us with 2 whole weeks to kind of make our own manifesto and decide what we actually want to make. Because until that point, we've been kind of doing cabaret gigs and we've been filler acts, and we were, or we still are, resident girl band at Women Seriously, which is a performance platform at the Yard Theatre in Hackney. So to have choreodrome and have 2 weeks together, it was kind of like our time to just be as one and create tracks just for us, rather than creating them in a mindset for another event or for someone else. We have performed at the V&A Lates, and we've also performed at Brainchild Festival in Sussex. since 2017. And we also run a thing called Open Band Practice, which we try to do as often as we can. And we've done it in Poland, I think we've done it in Edinburgh. But it's basically a chance for anyone to come and be a yoni, no matter how or who you identify as. Yeah, we do a thing called the Circle of Joy. We basically just dance in a circle all together and everyone gets a chance to be a leader. So we hope that the yonis can be inspiring, and we work kind of non-hierarchically and democratically as 10 women, which definitely comes with its challenges, but we hope that that can be an inspiring model to work from, especially within dance, when it's usually this kind of choreographer and dancer dynamic and there's a very clear hierarchy. So we are interested in breaking that. One of the main reasons why we formed was because contemporary dance is often viewed in a theatre. You often have to pay £16+ to go and see it. And a lot of people, I think, feel quite alienated by the sort of, yeah, kind of what I was saying before, the elitism of contemporary dance. Kind of like contemporary art is like this unspoken language that you feel like you need to get something. We came together because we kind of want to get rid of that and just dance. And also, when you're an audience watching, have an embodied experience like you would when you, if you went to see your favorite musician singing live. You're there with them, you're moving and experiencing this energy between you and whoever you're watching. So we also try not to perform in kind of black box theater spaces. We perform more in festivals or on the street, in the park, wherever really.
Sounds amazing. I've seen a little bit online about what you do. I've not seen you guys live, but I do really like how it does connect to that element of you talking before about really wanting to work at the elitist element in contemporary dance. Mm-hmm. And like you said, like I imagine 10 people trying to be democratic and make decisions where everyone feels heard and has had a say, definitely would have its challenges. But it's amazing that you've incorporated that into your practice already, identified it, and that must feel great despite the challenges.
Yeah, it does, because then when we get somewhere it's like, wow, that was actually, you know, everyone feels like they've been heard and like they were part of this decision and they have some sort of contribution or power within it.
So speaking of being heard, I'm going to go over to Leah.
He's been sitting very quietly and patiently.
So I'm wondering if you can tell me what you do in your role as a production assistant.
So as a production assistant at Shoot Europe, I get to assist on loads of really big, exciting campaigns. We're a really small company. There's now, I think we're down to about 4 of us, 3 in the Paris office and then me in the London office. We also have a sister company called Thursday's Child, which is a platform for emerging artists. So it's a really small all-women company, which was definitely a huge factor for me wanting to join when I interviewed. Yeah, production was never necessarily in my eye line for where I wanted to go after I graduated. I met Mai, who's now actually left the company, but when I first joined Shoot Europe, she was my boss who I was assistant to. I met her during my placement year. And when I graduated, I was working in a pizza place and living with my parents, which I'm not gonna lie, was actually really fun. But I thought, oh my God, I need to do something with this degree. I need to get out of Edinburgh. So luckily I texted her one day and then she was looking for an assistant. So it worked out really well. And I've actually really enjoyed it. There was a lot of teething issues with me kind of ending up in a more logistical job as opposed to creative, because that was where my heart really was. But I think it actually works quite well with my brain. And then I get to use, because it's kind of more of a 9-to-5, I get to use all of my other time for my own creative work. So it's actually quite nice. I don't kind of come home creatively drained, you know? So it definitely has its upside. But yeah, it's madness. Sometimes we spend a lot of time on set doing campaigns for Nike and Converse and Clarks. And it's really fun. Before I joined production, I would be on photo sets And I was just kind of like the styling assistant, you know, running around, sort of having no idea what anybody else was doing, just sort of frantically steaming clothes and burning my hands. So now it's quite nice to really understand how all of this gets put together and really understand the jigsaw pieces. It's actually quite impressive.
And it is slightly still connected to fashion.
Yeah, yeah. I guess kind of like what Jay was saying, I was so desperate to get a job, but I was certain that I was going to remain somewhat within the field. I guess I get to go to these sets now, and a lot of our work is prepping and kind of finding the location or the people or the hair, makeup or the styling. And I kind of get to go to these sets and actually stand back and sort of witness it, as opposed to being so in it at the time when you're, you know, part of the crew that's making it happen. So yeah, I guess it is. It's certainly a tangent of it, but it's there all the same.
Yeah. Okay. And so how would you say your like working day is structured, or your working week? Is it vary, or is it fairly consistent, or?
It really depends on the jobs that we have coming up. So we're probably about 60-40 in the office, 60% of the time, 40% on set. So we do all of the prep up towards a project, and then go on to set and make sure that all runs, and then do all the post. So I guess it's not that an exciting day-to-day job. It just sort of, it kind of all comes together, and then that's the exciting part.
So it's all that admin and planning, and then the moment of the shoot or whatever, and then back to the planning for the next one.
Exactly. And sometimes it is just a constant wheel of prep shoot, prep shoot, prep shoot, but it's good. I enjoy it. I get to travel sometimes as well, which is always a bonus.
Like Jay, you also graduated in 2018. So can you talk about your career pathway since then? I know you mentioned working in the pizza place and then also now at Sheet Europe, but yeah.
So yeah, I always wanted to work in fashion since I was a little girl. I started interning when I was 16 because that was just like, how else am I going to do it? I was just a little nobody from Edinburgh. And, you know, my uncle wasn't Dolce & Gabbana, so I had to find some way in.
That is a shame. Really.
Yeah, right?
You're all doing Dolce & Gabbana as uncles.
So, yeah, I had to find my way in somehow. So I worked at this little vintage shop in Edinburgh called Godiva, which was, they were so nice to me there. And I worked there on a Friday, and on a Wednesday I would intern for the in-house designer, who was just one of the most wonderful women, and she actually ended up writing me a reference to get me into uni. They were so supportive. Yeah, they were just great to work with. I then finished school and I went and did my art diploma in Canterbury in Kent, which was beautiful. Moving from Edinburgh to go there was, I think, probably a very good step for me, because it wasn't too wild, like Jay was saying. It wasn't like, wow, big city, you're 18, go and be wild. So quite good to be in a small little village. Well, it's not really a village, but compared to London, it is. And then I went and did my BA in Birmingham. And then whilst I was there, I thought, not a chance. I'm not staying here after I graduate. So I spent a lot of time coming down to London and working at London Fashion Week as a dresser, or for PR companies, or as you said in my intro, as a working for a stylist, and any magazines. I'm obsessed with magazines. So just really any chance that I could get. And then luckily, as I would say to anyone, it is just luck. The timing worked out. I'd met the right people during my placement year, that when I graduated, there was somebody who had a job for me. And that is how I ended up at Shoot Europe. So it always seems to be that case in all of my pals that work in the creative industry, that it's sort of like, you know, the hard work is there, but also the right time and right person,
for sure.
Yeah, it's that hard work and making those connections that then pay off down the line somehow.
Somehow.
Yeah.
Still waiting on a few of the other ones to pay off.
They're coming. Cool. Collectively, you have formed Viva La Volva. I'm wondering if you can, maybe in your own words, talk a little bit more about why you decided to start this, what forms and shapes it takes, and kind of how you manage it and how you both kind of input into it.
So before we start talking about Viva La Volva, We want to just give a quick disclaimer that when we're talking about women, we're spelling it WOMXN and are speaking inclusively to all those who want to have this discussion with us, however you identify. Viva la Vulva was created as a dance piece originally. I had had a lot of conversations with friends and various women about their relationship with sex and also their bodies. And what I kept finding was that it was shrouded in shame and embarrassment and humiliation. And it felt like, well, it feels like at the moment we're on a, you know, feminism's becoming a sort of populist wave, whether that's a good thing or not. And obviously capitalism means that you can buy feminism on a t-shirt, which may have been made in Bangladesh and exploited women, which is completely hypocritical to the whole movement. Yeah, there's problematic things with that, but I feel like fundamentally it is a positive that we're on this wave and it's becoming more accepted and less taboo to speak about issues that are female issues. So I was having these conversations and I thought, shit, I want to make a piece of art and dance that addresses that and in some way or another encourages people to have a conversation about that with the hope that it would empower women or, yeah, I mean, everything starts with a conversation. So yeah, I did that piece at Resolution Festival, which is at The Place every January, February. It's a festival for emerging dance artists. I did that last year. And
can you describe the performance a little bit for us?
Yeah. So influences for the work were Tracy Emin. She's got a piece called The Reason Why I'm Not a Dancer. It's a video and it's lots of scenes of Margate, where she grew up. And she's speaking about when she's like 14, maybe, years old. And she talks about all of these men that she was having sex with who were a lot older than she was. And she was a dancer, or she danced. And she was doing a dance competition and they all showed up and they started shouting like, "You're a slag," or whatever, at her. And she basically fell apart and couldn't continue doing this dance competition, and they ruined it for her. And
on a psychological traumatic level.
Yeah.
Not just the performance, but yeah.
But you know, her work is very all about that. I love it. She's a big influence, idol of mine. But she then, at the end of this video, it pans out and she's just standing in a dance studio dancing, and then she goes, "This is for you," and she names all of these men. And I remember watching it and being like, wow, that's just like, fuck you, that's amazing. How can I make something like that? There's nothing sort of in the piece that's like that, but that kind of influenced it. Stephanie Sarley, her Instagram account's been taken offline like loads of times, and she basically does stuff where she kind of, it's quite masturbatory, but she does it with fruit. So that was a big influence. We do a bit, me and my collaborator, Ronya Kasemi, we do a thing with a grapefruit where she kind of eats it, and then I do a thing with cherry tomatoes. We also collaborated with Rosie Whiting, who is a costume designer, and she, in order to make the costume, she did a survey, like an anonymous survey, and she asked women to describe having an orgasm and what that would taste like and what kind of textures it would feel like, and she made two separate, they're like dresses, but they're just like covered in different layers of fabric and stuff. And one of them's like lime green and pink, and it's kind of like poppy and fizzy. And then the other one's really dark, velvety red and purple and orange. So we wear those. And there's been a couple of iterations of the piece. In the first iteration, we also used quite a lot of, we pulled a lot of influence from an artist called Hannah Wilkie. She did an exhibition called SOS Starification Object Series, something like that, where she basically, she was a performance artist, and she asked people to take a piece of gum, chew it up, and then stick it on her naked body. And she described chewing gum as, or the way that we consume chewing gum, she compared it to the way that society treats women, in that they're like a packaged product and they're kind of chewed up and then spat out and disposable. That's how it kind of came to be.
Sorry, I'm wincing. It just feels so awful, doesn't it, to think of ourselves as this notion of like being that disposable, because it rings true. So I was just like, ooh. Sorry, yeah. I can see you looking at my face. I screwed up on that. And I've seen images of your work with that.
Yeah.
And it really is visceral. You kind of do kind of feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's kind of the point, I suppose. Yeah, so then I knew a lot of female identifying people and also non-binary people who were making work of a similar theme or of exploring a similar thing. And also Leah was doing a lot, and still is, I think, of research into witchcraft. And I thought, why not make a zine that could kind of broaden what I'm trying to do here and get more artists involved, ultimately, to kind of push the conversation further. And Leah, of course, is pro at and designing them. And I know that she, you had a magazine series, a zine series.
When, because we were in third year, we're in our final year at uni at the same time, so we were having a lot of these conversations that you've just described. We're having a lot of them together, and then Jay wanted to make a zine sort of thing to go with her dance. And I had a series of zines at uni called Vardo that were all about witchcraft and feminism. So yeah, it kind of was a little match made in heaven, because we realized Jay sort of had all of these artist pools that she wanted to have immortalized into a little zine, and then I loved making that. So yeah, it was birthed.
Yeah.
So the zine accompanied the dance performance?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you've gone on to have a zine making workshop?
Yeah, so it was like originally sort of as a, not like an advert, but was it not something to kind of give to people to get them to come to your show?
It was used as a sort of, instead of having a flyer, it was like...
Yeah, much more interesting.
Yeah, a more interesting thing to give people. But then also on the night of the performance, we had them everywhere. And I hope that everyone got one who came. And then I also wanted for all of the artists that contributed something to the zine, they were not necessarily from a dance kind of background, so it was also to sort of, in a selfish way, promote my own work. So they all got a free ticket to come and see the show, kind of as a sort of exchange.
It's not selfish, but anyway, carry on.
Yeah.
It's making work and collaborating.
That was kind of the starting idea, but since then it has grown.
Yeah. Yeah, then it kind of, I think we both just sort of realised how much fun we had sort of taking up that space with all of the conversations that we were sort of having, you know, just us two or with a lot of our like-minded feminist pals. But sort of getting that down on paper and having something tangible just felt so fun and great for us to do. I think it just sort of like sparked something in us. So decided to keep going. And we were really, really passionate about doing something non-hierarchical and, yeah, like non-elitist. I think that definitely probably comes a little bit from my background in magazines. So sick of being like the little intern that just made coffee. I want to be part of it all. So we decided we were going to do a live zine making workshop, which you came to. And yeah, that was sort of our next step. So then we knew that the second issue we wanted to do would be from a workshop. So it was great to sort of open up that floor for people. Me and Jay are quite lucky in that we have really open friends and family. So having this discussion, we weren't putting anything at stake by having these conversations, but it must be, or it is really troublesome for the vast majority. So we want to sort of open a door and say, like, come and make stuff with us and spend your Thursday evening sort of cutting and sticking. And then this really wonderful conversation kept coming from it. And it was really nice to witness because everyone was kind of busy doing things with their hands. So those that wanted to be loud could be, but then those that sort of just sat back and listened could.
It was definitely a very organic way of having what could perhaps be an awkward discussion.
Yeah.
We should probably say that for the first zine making workshop that you came to, we chose the topic of menstruation,
yeah,
or lack of.
I guess that was an easy step for us after you had kind of done a lot of the work into female sexuality and pleasure. We wanted to do another sort of similar thing. And I guess periods was just like, yeah, they're disgusting. No one ever wants to talk. Well, they're not disgusting, but everyone thinks they're disgusting. Nobody ever wants to talk about it. And we thought, we don't care talking about it. We'll stand up in a room and talk about it. And I think if you have that attitude, people almost give that back to you. They'll see that you're open and that you don't care that you're walking to the bathroom with a tampon in your hand instead of shoving it up your sleeve. Like, good God, why does anyone care? And so I think because we had that attitude, it opened up a space for everyone to feel comfortable to say uncomfortable things.
Yeah, it was a really interesting night because I didn't know anyone else other than you guys. And we'd only met once before, Jay. So it was really interesting observing that. And there was different age groups and different backgrounds in the room, which was really lovely. And it's about 15 people?
Yeah.
So it was really like dynamic. And like some of the conversations, I was like, really like, wow, people are so open about talking about situations they've had. And yeah, it made me really think about situations I'd had in terms of bleeding and having disasters and those conversations, but also the different products people use, the impact on the environment. I didn't realize tampons go off, that I learned a fact that night. So yeah, it was really, it felt like people coming together and talking about their health and their bodies in a really natural way because we were also making, so we could physically create something. Mm-hmm. So we weren't just looking at each other and having quite, not a heavy conversation, but a conversation where potentially you could start feeling a bit awkward or feeling not so open or wanting to share. I think the combination of making the zine and then cutting out images and, you know, sticking them down. And like I said, I got obsessed with these red tassels that you guys bought. And the conversation just flowed and it was such an amazing energy in the room.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. And I think everyone came out kind of like, wow, I can't believe I admitted a lot of that stuff in front of a room of, you know, okay, it was maybe 12, 14 people, but it's still stuff that is so shrouded in shame and embarrassment. And, you know, you use these sort of phrases like time of the month, you know, even just that comes so naturally to women. Why would you not just say you're on your period? I mean, I'm not giving anyone a hard go. I say the exact same things, but I think everyone kind of came out thinking, God, that was so nice to just get these little things off my chest. Or, yeah, I've seen adverts for moon cups on Instagram, but how do you use those? You know, these things that maybe also because I think me and Jay have had this conversation a lot in this new wave of feminism. There's so much of kind of stigma of not using the right words or not saying the right thing. And we didn't want the workshop to be anything like that. We wanted people to just come and speak. And there wasn't going to be a sort of like, oh, you can't say that. It was going to be, oh, so like this was how you should probably refer to it, or this is how you would use that, or, you know.
Yeah, I think also the whole idea behind having the workshops was to get people to meet each other, actually, because we realized that in the first issue, I was kind of like talking about each artist that had contributed something, but I realized that they didn't know each other. But I knew all of them, or we knew all of them, or you didn't know.
Oh, no, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, I knew all these amazing people that were doing these amazing things. And I was like, oh my God, they need to meet each other.
Yeah.
So then from there, we were like, well, how can we make that happen? Why does it need to be that we're kind of editors that sit on a high horse and decide whose contributions are the best? Why can't we just all come together, everyone meet each other and discuss this topic whilst making something collectively? And yeah, I suppose encouraging the collectivity of making something is becoming more and more valuable in this sort of tech-heavy society yeah. that we're moving into.
Yeah, more of a focus on the production rather than the end product was definitely quite important, or is important to us still.
The process, yeah.
Yeah, the process.
What are your ambitions for it? So you did that workshop where you brought people together, which was awesome, and you are now, or you have put together all the contributions.
Yep.
Yeah.
In the best way you can, because there was a lot happening that night. I produced several myself. Everyone was just like on a frantic frenzy of making.
Yes,
no, it was great.
Yeah, it did take us a while to identify whose work was whose, but we have made sure that everyone has at least one page.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what is the ambitions now going forward? I guess printing the zine? Are we close to that?
Yeah. So it's all set up. It's all PDF'd and exported. And that will be going hopefully to the printers this weekend once we've kind of had our final perusal. But yeah, it's all ready to go and then it will get sent back to us. And then we on the first issue, we kind of didn't have a font or anything that we stuck to. So when it arrives, we cut out like tape and just write on the front of it, like Viva La Vulva, just to be even more tangible and sort of on it.
So the longer term ambitions for the zine were to pick a topic for each zine to begin with. And then for each workshop, we wanted to team up with a charity which relates to that topic. So Leah has been in touch with Bloody Good Period, which are a charity based in the UK.
So they work on supplying period products like sanitary towels and stuff to refugees and vulnerable women.
So when we print the zines, we would love to go to a zine fair. And the goal for the zine, for Viva La Vulva, was we don't really want people to pay for it. And we can't actually justify that if we're having 20 people in a workshop contribute to that, because we'd be selling their work. So what we want to do for this one anyway is, instead of buying the zine, you would exchange it for some sanitary products. And then those products in turn will be donated to Bloody Good Period, who will then pass them on to the women who need them.
That's an awesome idea. I love that. That's amazing.
Yeah, we really didn't want to do it for profit. Side note, I know that is the most privileged thing, of course. But we are lucky to be able to make work that doesn't have to be for profit. So we instead, of making £2-3 off a zine, we wanted to do something with it that was also just going to keep the cycle going,
And also because we want to hold on to the original kind of underground roots of zine making, which is kind of underground and
like political. And punk.
So we had an idea that for the next zine making workshop, we wanted to pick the topic of breasts, and we were maybe going to get someone from a breast cancer charity to come in and do like a quick how to check your breasts
yeah.
for lumps. And then we would do a collection for a breast cancer charity.
I'm only laughing because you just did check your breasts.
Yeah, I did.
You know. You can tell she's a dancer. Yeah.
So yeah, those are the long-term goals. We were also lucky enough to hold the first workshop that you came to at the Albany in Deptford, and we are really hoping that we can continue to work with them because they're an amazing venue and arts organisation in South East London.
What I'm really keen to talk to you both about, and you both touched on it anyway, is about what producing your own work that you have control, autonomy over, what does that give you both? You kind of mentioned when you're at uni you needed to do something just so that you could. And you're talking about really trying to change an industry to a degree.
I guess it's just like an amalgamation of both of those things. We wanted the power to be ours and the control and liberation.
For me, although a lot of my friends who are also dance artists talk a lot about wanting to make art or make dance which changes the world, you know, it's very easy to say I want to change the world with my art or with my dance. But I think that you can be a choreographer and you can make dance for theatres for your whole life and never know if you're actually making a difference or if you are just kind of further contributing to the bourgeoisie, go and watch contemporary dance. But I think that in holding zine workshops and trying to reach people beyond our friend group also, which we're trying to do, and kind of bring people together around these topics and just discuss things and make things with our hands together around a table, it's a direct exchange with people, and it feels much more like you're making a difference in some way than putting something on a stage.
Yeah.
For me personally.
Yeah. So how can people, if you're trying to reach a broader audience and a broader exchange opportunity, how can people find Viva La Volva? Do you have stuff coming up? Where can they locate you? How can they get in contact and get involved?
At the moment, our first issue of Viva La Volva is in the Vagina Museum in Camden.
Yay!
I know you can't see, but we're both wearing our badges. We're very proud.
Very nice. Yeah. We're going to take some pictures.
They have like a table of stuff that's for free. I think it's probably next to a leaflet about bacterial vaginosis. So you can pick up one of those as well. And we're hoping that the second issue can live in there as well. We don't have another zine workshop date confirmed yet, but you can go on either of our Instagrams or my website. So that's at JUL, all one word, on Instagram, or
at Leah, LIA. _AIR
Yeah, or jyule.com to find out when the next ones are.
We'll put those details in the show notes as well.
Okay, cool. Great.
So going back to your careers and where you are now, I'm wondering if you can both tell me what's maybe the biggest challenge you've both faced since leaving university and coming into the industry, or even whilst at university.
So probably something that we always discuss, especially when we were sort of trying to get our feet in these industries, was ever getting paid for anything. Especially, I think it was probably for the same for you when you're at dance school, but at uni, the tutors would just batter you over the head with how much you had to say yes to everything, regardless of who it was or if you were going to end up actually paying loads of your own money to actually then work for someone, which just in its own is ridiculous.
/ corrupt.
Yeah, exactly. But that was, yeah. It was the only way. It was like, just go and sell yourself over and over again. And yeah, it actually got to a point when I graduated uni, I was still looking at free internships, because they really, the amount they spoke about that kind of just, that made me feel like that was all I was worth. Mm. And maybe I wouldn't necessarily say struggled, but kind of fought with the idea of, okay, but when am I worthwhile money? And it's almost, yeah, I had to take a step back to say, well, of course I am. I have a degree. I have, not that a degree necessarily is equal to being paid for what you do, but, you know, we had all of this experience and we were still grappling with getting paid for things. And I think that that's definitely something that you, Jay, still kind of grapple with.
Still.
Yeah, the creative industries, I think, is rife for free internships. It's so unacceptable as well.
Yeah. Well, all it results in is, as an artist, you end up with quite low self-worth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not actually realizing when you should be paid for something. Mm-hmm. And when someone is, yeah, just taking advantage of you. Yeah, it's still something that I'm, yeah, weighing up if I should take things for free and what's in it for the long run and all of these things. When, I mean, I do think that probably in other industries there's a level of that sort of graduate kind of exploitation, but yeah, it doesn't feel quite as
but it goes back to a cycle of perpetuation, because at university, if they're constantly telling you need to work for free, that's priming the industry that actually people will work for free. If everyone doesn't work for free, then they have to find the money.
Yeah.
And I have a real issue with that. Sophie Thomas, who was an amazing guest, she's a costume and set designer, and she was at the end of series one. And she talks so eloquently about that issue and about working for so little money and it really impacting on her mental health, and about how she dealt with that and managed to work through that and having to really find a place where she could accept that actually it wasn't okay, because she had been told and encouraged and pushed to work for zero money, for little money, for £300 for a job that went over months, you know.
And you're also stuck between a rock and a hard place, because, you know, you'll maybe get a little pep talk from someone that's like, no, you're ready to be paid now, as if there's sort of a qualification of that, which there isn't. And then you go to these interviews and you want to ask for that, but you're also persistently made aware that you are a drop in the ocean when it comes to, I know definitely in starting out in the fashion industry, there are hundreds of girls and there's so many people that can do it for free. So why are they ever going to pick you if you're asking for, you know, you're not even, most of the time, you're not even getting minimum wage. You're getting nothing in exchange for your sweat and hours that you put in for them. And, you know, you kind of have to take it, because they're not going to turn around and go, oh, do you know what? We really need this 18-year-old on board with us. They're going to go, okay, thank you, next.
I do think that in some cases, when you do speak up and ask, like, no, I do need to be paid for that, the people that you're up against, like these big companies or organizations, like often they do have the money, but they just know that they can get away with not paying you. So yeah, it's also like imparting this fear of asking, because you're disposable, that creates the cycle of
totally
not ever getting paid.
That being said,
we're both very aware of our privilege and that we wouldn't be where we are if we weren't able to work for free, and that's a result of us being privileged white women.
Yeah, coming from our backgrounds and having that support, that is 100%. We know that that is not a commonality, and that we are specifically lucky to have been able to work for free. But then that's just another issue that is a whole other tangent, because then the industry just keep churning out the same I don't know.
Type of person.
Yeah, it's a barrier. It's a barrier to the creative industries across the whole, not just in dance, probably not just in fashion, in production as well. Yeah. I've got a real issue about that.
Yeah.
People can't even get their foot in the door because working for free is not an option.
Exactly. Or yeah. Working in, living in London.
Yeah.
You know.
So we're going to wrap up now. So I think what would be really useful is maybe if either one of you answer one of these questions. So is there a career or job in the creative industries that you know little about and you'd like to know more about? So maybe whoever wants to answer that. And then secondly, is there a woman that you'd like to recommend that I get in touch with to get onto the podcast?
A career or job in the creative industries that I know little about, but I've always been curious about. Either a female wrestler or a female footballer. Oh yeah, we also had a sex worker. We thought that would be an interesting industry to talk about. Or a female firefighter or a nurse. But I suppose they're not directly in the creative industries. But anyway.
Who knows?
Yeah.
There might be some way, some crossover.
Is football creative? Probably not. No, it's not.
Some people.
We'll stick with female wrestler.
Okay.
Yes.
So a woman within the creative industries that we would love to hear on Greater Than 11% would be Hannah Gadsby, Tash Dimitriou, Maisie Hill, author of Period Power, or Juno Mack and Molly Iso Smith, authors of Revolting Prostitutes and Lizzo.
I'm pretty sure I can get all of those in that.
Yeah, I know, right? We can't wait to listen to all of those.
Yeah. And if we do manage to get Lizzo, I'll make sure you're here.
Please.
Yeah,
please call us.
We'll be like her interns. We'll get her warm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paid interns, obviously. Yeah.
What an honour.
It's been so like fab talking to you both. And like I said, I so loved the zine workshop. So yeah, I think anyone who is interested in making zines and learning more about their bodies and contributing to something that, again, like you're saying, connecting it to kind of charities, yeah, should definitely follow you guys on Instagram or check out what you're up to. Thank you so much for your lovely energy and answers and, yeah, for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, we've had a great time.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. Also, stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases.